Before we start today's show, we just wanted to share some exciting news with you all. We've launched our own Patreon page. Your donations will help with costs of producing and bringing you a show with better content such as on-site visits to prisons, prison phone calls, interviews, and much, much more. For only $6, you get a pros and cons sticker and pin, a Patreon exclusive episode every month. This could be a Q&A, interview with a special guest, update to a previous case, and a shout out on our social media and your name added to our website as a contributor. It also includes access to our private Slack group where you can get behind scene updates like upcoming episodes, inmate artwork sent to Bethany, and then you can just chat with us and other listeners. Head on over to www.patreon.com/mouthoffnetwork and select the pros and cons tier to become a patron today. This week on the pros and cons, when a local millionaire is murdered in his bed, everyone is a suspect, but the true culprit is a mystery.
We're the pros and cons, two true crime television producers, Bethany Jones, that's me.
And Adriana Padilla.
That's you. With each episode, we talk to the pros that lived and worked and produced the cases and about the cons that made the headlines. We'd like to start off this episode by thanking our new Patreon supporters, Mary Alice and Angela.
Thank you.
Woo! Thank you. Our two sheroes. We are beyond excited to have you support our show and can't wait to get your goodies to you and also your exclusive content. I've already enjoyed our chats on Slack.
That's true.
And as many of you know, the Pros and Cons podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts, including TuneIn, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and your favorite Android and podcast apps. We also find it very helpful when you subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other true crime fans find us. And if you want to find out what we're up to or get a deep dive into the true crime news of the week, follow us at Facebook and Instagram at the Pros and Cons Podcast and Twitter at the Pros and Cons Show. We post daily about our show and about true crime news you might have missed. And you can also feel free to email us at theprosandconspodcast@gmail.com. And we're very excited because we were recently approached by Golden Road Brewery, which is in Glendale and has other locations throughout Southern California, to host a monthly meetup called Macabre Mondays.
Yeah, so the last Monday of every month, we're going to have these meetups with other true crime lovers, my favorite murder fans, other podcasts, you know, special guests from law enforcement, some of the cases you might know.
Absolutely. It's basically where you will find your people. So
yes, your tribe.
Yeah, we're really excited. You know, Jamie from Murderish will be coming to some of them. I know that you know, War Baby from Murderous Minors. We're going to have just a wealth of, you know, true crime fans, true crime producers, true crime professionals. And
yeah, and it's such a cool venue that has amazing beer. We're going to do it in a speakeasy.
Yeah, they have a private speakeasy. So don't worry, we won't freak out the table next to us.
Exactly, with all our murder talk. And we'll give you the passcode to get in. And yeah. also they have vegan and also non-vegan food there. So
they do.
You have like dietary needs. This is like the perfect place for you.
It's the perfect place. And also one last social update. In April, we have the Victory for Victims 5K. And that is with CATS, the Center for Abuse Treatment Services, which is the only nonprofit organization that provides services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, rape, and human trafficking in the Los Angeles and Santa Clarita area. Please come out April 20th and join us. And for National Crime Victims Awareness Week, because we have special guests and we're going to be, not only promoting our brand, but you'll be promoting and supporting a really important need in our community.
And you'll be speaking this year as well.
Mm-hmm, I will. And giving some of our favorite fans and friends accolades, giving them their awards and recognition, including some of the Dirty John victims.
Yeah, so it's so cool that you do that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so awesome.
I say this after having gone on about not going on the treadmill. I'm now inviting you all to a 5K.
We're like, don't exercise. But if you exercise, do it for a good cause.
Do it for a good cause. I power walk the 5K, and it's dog friendly. So my dog will be there.
Aw.
Yeah. Without further ado, I'd love to jump into today's case, Adriana. I know it's one of the cases that you've covered and one that we've talked about. So
yes, I actually talked about it a bit on a Q&A episode of our old show, The Queens of Crime. But I went through, just the beats. So if it sounds familiar, and it's because you've been a fan of us for a long time, and I have mentioned it before. But this time, I think it's time to do a deep dive.
A deep dive.
Into this case. And it's really a wild case about greed, betrayal, and Dungeons and Dragons. So this case takes place in 1988 in Little Washington, North Carolina, which is a sleepy coastal town in the heart of North Carolina's Inner Banks. Little Washington has the distinction of being the first city in the United States named in honor of George Washington, so many locals consider it the original Washington.
Oh.
And that's what they call it. It's a place where Spanish moss hangs from trees and antebellum homes lined the nearby Pamlico River. Little Washington was a place where Leith von Stein and his family called home.
That's quite a name.
Yes, Leith von Stein.
Okay.
It's German.
Oh.
So, but, he was an American boy born in New York, and then he was brought to North Carolina by his family. Leith von Stein was 42 years old, and he was a big shot around town. Not only was he the head of internal auditing for mega corporation National Spinning Company, but he also was the sole heir of the Camel City Dry Cleaners and Laundry, which was one of the largest dry cleaning chains in the state. So he was rolling in cash.
Oh, and in a small town, I bet that caught a lot of people's eyes.
It really did. So, he was a man about town in North Carolina. And he was known for his keen mind, his way with numbers, and his love of computers.
Okay.
Leith was also known as a good husband to his wife, Bonnie, and her children, Chris and Angela. Leith and Bonnie were an interesting pair, especially for that time. Bonnie was 2 years older than Leith and had small children from a previous marriage, so she was a divorcee.
Oh.
Which was not that common back in the the early 80s.
Nor was having a wife that was slightly older.
Yeah, so his family, they were kind of like, well, what is up with this relationship? But he really loved her, and wow, he wanted to be a good husband to her, but they were opposites. Bonnie's father was a brick mason. She came from an ultra-religious family of five. Meanwhile, Leith was an only child of wealthy parents. And so kind of
you know, a Cinderella story of sorts when he decided to marry Bonnie, because she had been abandoned by her first husband and had been struggling to raise her two children all by herself as a single mother.
Well, being a single mother anytime is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so Leith comes in and everything changes for Bonnie and the kids. They went from living paycheck to paycheck to having European vacations and fancy dinners. Leith even opened a line of credit for her at Montaldo's, which is a ritzy department store that before she could not even think of shopping there at all.
Is that kind of like a Nordstrom's?
I wonder if it still exists, but it's kind of like Macy's in the day.
Ooh, fancy schmancy.
I know. So she was living it up. But at the same time, Leith was falling into the step-parent trap of trying to buy the kids love. And despite giving them all these creature comforts that they never had had before, Leith really struggled to win over Chris and Angela, especially as they became teenagers. Leith especially clashed with Chris. Leith found his stepson to be lazy and unmotivated, and the two often fought. Luckily, Bonnie was always there to ease Leith's temper and broker peace at home.
And by 1988, when this story takes place, the family had settled into the community. Things at home could be tense, but since both kids were leaving the nest, it seemed like things would settle down. By now, Bonnie von Stein, Leith's wife, was known throughout the community for her work with animals. Bonnie spent most of her time at the local Humane Society and filled the von Stein home with rescues. At one point, the family was fostering 13 cats, a pair of dogs, and a rooster. That is certainly a lot more than your two cats and Yuki.
Yeah, I do have two cats and a dog.
Well, but we, you know, and I've got my dog that we, you know, post about, but we co-parent. They're not with us all the time.
13 cats is a lot of cats.
It's a lot of cats, man. Bonnie's daughter, Angela, also shared her mother's love of animals. Angela especially loved horses and was a regular fixture at the Five Points Equestrian Center. As for older brother Chris, he was now a freshman at North Carolina State, but he preferred to lose himself in the fantasy worlds and video games. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's a fun way to pass time. I know as a kid, I really enjoyed Super Mario and Street Fighter 2.
Oh, yeah. Street Fighter. What was your...
Chun-Li.
Chun-Li?
Yeah.
I forgot which one. I think I was E. Honda, because you get him in the corner and you go blah, 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 with your fist.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. That was a solid choice.
There's like this, a belly jump you do, yep, where you just land on people. So, you know, video games is fine.
Yeah. He also fancied himself, Chris that is, as a bit of a writer, aspiring to become a novelist after college, which only adds to Leith's disappointment. Leith viewed fiction writing as a waste of time and begins to plot to how to get his stepson back on track. But this plan would quickly take a backseat to more pressing and tragic events.
Within a span of 6 months, both of Leith's beloved parents died, sending Leith into a spiral of depression. And you can imagine it's hard enough to lose one family member, but to lose both parents at the same time is just a horrible blow to him. But it all wasn't bad news. Leith's parents had left him an estate worth $2 million, which in 1988 was a lot of money.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a lot. Now it'll get you maybe a 4-bedroom house in California. But $2 million at that time was a huge amount of money. And Chris and Angela, his stepchildren, assumed that this princely inheritance would perk up their stepdad. But they couldn't be more wrong. Managing the family fortune only added to Leith's stress, and he pored over investment books late into the night, worrying about his every move. To take the edge off, Leith started to drink heavily. First cases of beer, then bottles of vodka. And as his mood darkened, tension simmered throughout the household.
And bottles of vodka, that's significant.
Yeah, he was definitely leaning toward a problem.
Right, right.
And one of the family members who decided to take the high road and try to calm the waters by falling in line was stepson Chris. Once Leith's main source of aggravation, Chris decided he wanted to make his stepdad proud. Forgoing his dream of becoming a writer, Chris switched majors to engineering to be just like his stepfather. He even applied for a summer job at Leith's company. Unfortunately for Chris, all his efforts backfired. Engineering just wasn't for him. Chris's grades were so bad, he flunked out of most of his engineering classes and had to attend summer school. So whatever his plan was to kind of impress his stepfather, it didn't go the way he wanted.
And obviously it didn't go the way he wanted for his academic career.
Yeah.
You know?
Stepdaughter Angela, meanwhile, could care less about her stepfather's feelings. You know, while her father kind of spiraled into this, you know, depression, she was still a high schooler. She decided to rebel against her family and started hanging out with a wilder crowd, including a boyfriend whose violent tendencies once landed him in a stretch in juvie.
Mm.
Once Leith found out about Angela's boyfriend, Leith banned her boyfriend from the house, said, you know, I don't want him coming anywhere near us. But that only encouraged Angela to sneak out even more. Leith was at the end of his rope, and so was Bonnie, but Angela wasn't the only one sneaking around. Around that time, Bonnie caught Leith sneaking out to get comfort outside the home with another woman.
Ooh.
Yeah, Leith had made fast friends with a woman he met at a business conference. And though she lived in California, the pair had maintained regular contact. Bonnie had intercepted a letter to the woman from Leith, and though it appeared they hadn't slept together, that there wasn't a full-blown affair, Bonnie was really angry and hurt.
And in 1988, you know, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have any of these dating apps that could keep the spark alive like it is now. Now it's like, you know, snail mail, like how I have to reach out to my inmates, you know? And let me tell you, it can take forever.
To get mail?
Yeah.
So he was sending all these letters to this random lady. And even if it wasn't a physical affair, it was definitely an affair of the heart.
Right.
And Bonnie had already been abandoned by one husband. I bet you she was thinking,
yeah,
I don't want to go through this again.
Yeah.
Who could have known that fate would take them in a very different direction?
In the wee hours of Monday, July 25th, most of Little Washington was asleep in their beds when their small-town fantasy came crashing down. Police dispatch received a terrifying call from the Von Stein household. The voice on the other end was so weak it was almost a whisper. They couldn't make out much, but they sensed this person was in danger. First responders rushed to the Von Stein home and found a sliding glass door unlocked at the back of the house. Oh, that gives me the chills because I have a sliding glass door at the back of my house.
And those sliding glass doors.
I mean, they'll get you. They searched the house, eventually finding the master bedroom, and were confronted with a scene of horror unlike any these small-town cops had ever witnessed. Lying diagonally across the bed was the body of patriarch Leith Von Stein, completely covered in his own blood. He had been murdered with an impressive savagery, beaten so brutally that blood was spattered on all four walls and the ceiling of the master bedroom. So, and not to get graphic, but it sounds almost like it's a 360-degree blood spatter, which shows the ferocity of the crime. Am I wrong?
Correct. Even the ceiling.
Oh my goodness. He had also been stabbed 8 times with 6 gaping wounds in his head. As investigators take in the horror of this scene, they heard a commotion under the bed. Someone else was in the room. Weapons drawn, they pulled up the bed skirt to find Bonnie von Stein still clutching the telephone, and she's been badly injured. Before she allowed paramedics to take her away, Bonnie demanded police find her daughter, Angela. At the opposite end of the home from the master bedroom, police opened the door to Angela's bedroom. Angela was startled awake and sat up in her bed. She seemed completely unharmed and was whisked outside without being told what was happening. From the back seat of a police cruiser, Angela watched in shock as her mother was taken out of the house and sent to the hospital, followed by her stepfather's remains en route to the medical examiner's office. After the scene was locked down, detectives and CSI techs began scouring the home for clues. As chaotic as the scene in the bedroom was, there was little evidence to be found. No weapon, and nothing that could identify the killer. But as investigators began searching through the home, a possible motive was revealed. There are several cabinets and drawers opened in the kitchen. 2 purses sat on the countertop with the contents of a third spread across the island. This clearly looked to have started as a robbery, as good a motive as any, considering the ritzy neighborhood. And yet, in a house brimming with treasure, the robber didn't take much, not any of the expensive TVs and stereos, along with Leith's wallet, watch, and I'm sure they had a jewelry collection.
Yeah, Bonnie had an extensive jewelry collection, and that also was untouched.
Was it a robbery then? There was a broken window on the side of the house suggesting forced entry, except for the fact that the resulting hole was too small for anyone to climb through. And the sliding glass door to the back patio, where emergency responders entered, was already unlocked, yet another glaring sign of a staged robbery. Investigators canvassed the neighborhood and recent police dockets to find out if this crime fit any known profile, and they came up empty. This was the only reported break-in in the neighborhood in years. Plus, the combination of nothing missing and a killing committed with such rage ruled out any realistic motive for a thief looking for a quick score. So maybe the murder of Leith von Stein wasn't a random crime after all. Maybe it was a targeted hit.
Investigators in the Leith von Stein murder started their investigation with a visit to the hospital, where Bonnie was recovering from her injuries. Bonnie said she and Leith went to dinner around 7 p.m., not far from the home. When the couple returned, they had a short conversation with Angela, who's watching TV in her room, before they had a nightcap. Bonnie claimed they went to bed by 11 p.m. Bonnie says she remembered nothing else after that, not even her call to 911. Doctors said it wasn't surprising Bonnie remembered so little given the sheer brutality of the attack. Fortunately, Bonnie's injuries, while serious, were not life-threatening. That does raise another point, however. It's curious that a killer would cause so much damage to Leith and simply allow Bonnie to hide under the bed. Then again, as the sole beneficiary of Leith's several million dollars, there may be more to the story than meets the eye. For one thing, Bonnie's wounds were largely superficial.
Oh.
Could she have inflicted them on herself to throw police off the trail? At first, police took Bonnie at her word until they received the results back from Leith's autopsy. The report showed that there may be a hole in Bonnie's accounting of that night. the most puzzling among them being the timing of Leith's last meal. During the autopsy, the medical examiner found that Leith's stomach was completely full, meaning that he had to have eaten dinner around 9 p.m., not 2 hours earlier, as Bonnie claimed, which was very strange indeed. But for now, investigators put Bonnie on the back burner to question the other family members. Investigators tracked down Angela at a friend's home where she had been staying because the family home was a crime scene. Detectives were immediately struck by how much Angela lacked emotions.
Yeah.
It just seemed like she was more concerned about how this was ruining her summer plans more than her mom almost dying and her stepfather being dead.
Right.
Angela admitted to police she didn't have a great relationship with her stepfather, but insisted she was innocent. She claimed she slept through the attack. But investigators wondered, how could she have heard nothing? Angela's room was only 20 feet away from the murder scene, and the doors in the house were hollow.
Yeah, that would be hard to not have heard anything at all.
We're talking about a brutal beating.
Right.
And then a window being broken.
Right.
I mean, there are people who sleep very soundly, but...
I mean, I've slept through minor earthquakes, but I wouldn't have slept through this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we went on a trip recently, and apparently I passed out halfway through a conversation. So, but I mean, it was definitely suspect, but that wasn't the only thing that was fishy. Looking back at the photographs taken in Angela's room the night of the murder raised another red flag for investigators. Angela had a half-full glass of ice water on the nightstand, odd considering she claimed to sleep through the entire attack. If she had this ice, you would think it would have been melted, unless she woke up during the attack, got herself some ice water, and went back to bed. So those things just didn't make any sense. Perhaps Angela was trying to kill both parents and grab a pile of money for herself. Of course, she's not the only one who could stake that claim. Considering his issues with Leith, son Chris might have been considered a suspect, but he has a very strong alibi. He was over 100 miles away at North Carolina State, drinking and playing cards until he returned to his dorm to finish his term paper. Several friends verified his whereabouts, but Chris was not out of the woods yet. Chris may have been at school during the murder, but he hadn't been away from home for very long. Just days before the murder, Chris came home for a surprise visit and got into another argument with Leith over his poor grades. The timing certainly raised eyebrows. Investigators now had three good suspects, but no real foothold in the case. Detectives worried they may never know the answer to Leith's murder, until an unexpected clue turned up in a surprising place.
As investigators in Little Washington had discovered, the Von Stein home had been hiding some ugly secrets. But as hard as they dig, they can't find enough evidence to crack the case. That was until they get a curious call from a pig farmer on the outskirts of town. The pig farmer said he saw a fire the night of the murder. Since it seemed self-contained, he thought nothing of it at the time. But now he wondered if it was connected to the crime. Sure enough, this was no innocent fire. Investigators uncover a treasure trove of evidence in the ashes, including what they believe to be a potential murder weapon. A melted but intact hunting knife that matches the blade size of the one that killed Leith Von Stein. The They also found scraps of burnt clothing and shoes, as well as the pièce de résistance. Preserved toward the bottom of the pile of ash and seared kindling was a crumpled piece of paper. The word Lawson was clearly visible. It only took a moment for the detectives to realize what they're staring at. Lawson was the street where the Von Steins live, and they had a hand-drawn map leading directly to the house. But who would need that? Certainly not one of the family members. Detectives dug deeper into each Von Stein's network of friends and acquaintances. All of Bonnie and Angela's friends lived close by and would know how to get to Lawson Drive. Now Chris, half a state away at college, comes under increased scrutiny. Investigators question Chris's college neighbors, roommates, and friends. And under the stress of police questioning, one of them wilts. Neil Henderson, a Dungeons & Dragons partner of Chris's, swore he did not kill Leith Von Stein, but he knew who did. According to Neil, Chris told a few close friends that he'd had enough of Leith's constant criticism. Chris fantasized about killing his stepfather and the freedom Leith's money could bring if it were all his own. Chris shared his dark fantasies with a new friend, James Upchurch, who already had a rap sheet for two breaking and entering offenses, and together, Chris and James began plotting. Chris and James concocted a plan to kill the Von Stein family, including his mother Bonnie and sister Angela. Originally, the plan was to put sleeping pills in the family's food during Chris's out-of-the-blue visit a few days prior to the murder, but the duo changed their minds. Chris returned to the university to establish a solid alibi, while James went to the Von Stein house to carry out the deadly deed. Chris provided James with a hand-drawn map and a hunting knife. And how does Neil know all this? Because he was recruited to be James's driver, since the trigger man didn't have a license. As payment for their crime, Chris offered the two guys a reward, $50,000 and a car, a Porsche for Upchurch and a Ferrari for Henderson, as soon as he got his inheritance, of course. On the night of the actual murder, Henderson said he drove Upchurch from Raleigh to the Von Stein home and then returned him to Raleigh, stopping along the way to discard bloodied clothing and to burn evidence, including a map of the neighborhood, which was found by the pig farmer. Police find and arrest James, who corroborates Neil's story. Chris was arrested a day later. All three men were tried for the murder of Leith Von Stein. James Bartlett Upchurch III was convicted of first-degree murder, while Chris and Neil Henderson were convicted of aiding and abetting the murder. And for these crimes, James Bartlett Upchurch was sentenced to death. Upchurch's death sentence was set aside on October 1, 1992, and he was resentenced to life imprisonment. He will not be eligible for parole until 2022.
So it's coming up.
It is. A few years away. Henderson was also convicted of murder in the second degree. He was sentenced to 40 years imprisonment, and he was paroled on December 11th, 2000. Ironically, it was Leith Von Stein's money that saved Chris from the electric chair. Armed with the best legal defense team in the state, Chris was able to make a cushy plea deal with the DA. Chris was paroled in 2007 after serving only 18 years for his part in his stepfather's death.
Yeah, so ironically, despite the fact that Chris was the mastermind behind his stepfather's death, Bonnie ended up inheriting all of Leith's money, and she used a good sum of that to help her son get out of, not get out, but at least
Get a reduced sentence.
Get a reduced sentence, avoid life in prison or avoid the death penalty.
What was their relationship like now?
Well, after the crime, his mother continued to visit him every week. And she forgave him for the attempt on her life.
Wow.
Fairly soon. By the time he went to trial, she had already forgiven him and she was working on saving his life.
Yeah.
And after he served 18 years for his stepfather's death, he actually returned to Little Washington and, being this murderous prodigal son, returned and lived with his mother.
Today, the murder of Leith von Stein has become Little Washington's most enduring legend, even more famous for the many things about the case that remain unsolved.
Yes, so there's still the question of the contents of Leith's stomach, which has never been answered.
Yeah.
Why, if the timeline said that he had eaten, you know, hours before, why was his stomach full? There's a couple theories. One of them was that he had been drugged and that had slowed down the digestive process.
Oh, interesting.
And there was also speculation that Bonnie might have been involved and had not been honest about the timeline.
And what about Angela and the ice cubes? Because that seemed to point the finger at her.
Well, Angela definitely... First of all, Angela has never been implicated.
Okay.
She was never fully a suspect. But when talking to investigators, that was something that was definitely suspect, just because...
Right, of course.
Someone let... Somehow James Upchurch got into the house.
Right.
And we don't know how.
Because the sliding glass door at the back.
Yes, was open. So speculation, not proven, is that Angela let him in. And there's also rumors that the two of them had become involved and that Angela was involved in this.
Oh.
But, you know, they just don't have enough evidence to prove it. These are all rumors.
Now, I know at the time of the murder, there was a lot of satanic panic, and kind of talk to me a little bit about that. Did that play into this case anymore? What was the community's feeling about it?
So this happened in a time when there was just this societal belief that Satanists were everywhere and they're out to get your kids, and they were, you know, sacrificing rabbits, and there was this real, which now when you think about it, ridiculous fear.
Yeah,
that there were these cults around, and, you know, the soul of America was at stake. And you see it in a bunch of different cases, like the McMartin preschool scandal. And
oh, yeah. And with the, I get this wrong every, I always say, want to say the Westboro Memphis 3, and that's wrong because I'm combining the Westboro Baptist Church with the Memphis 3. But isn't it the West Memphis 3?
Yeah.
Wasn't there like a satanic panicky kind of element
vibe to it? So there was a bunch of cases during this time, and one of the things that people really looked at as being just corrupting the kids was, of all nerdy things, Dungeons and Dragons. And there's actually several cases where Dungeons and Dragons was tied to a case, just like, you know, with Upchurch, James Upchurch, Chris, and Henderson, they were all part of a Dungeons and Dragons group, and they all hung out.
Yeah.
And that just became a huge sensational part of this case because there was this fear that, oh, this Dungeons and Dragons and the Satanism and this is bringing the kids to murder their parents, when really, I mean, it was greed. It was plain,
just
run-of-the-mill greed. But it definitely made this a very, very high-profile case at the time, to the point where there's actually been two novels written about this case.
Really?
And two made-for-TV movies.
Oh.
One of which is called Cruel Doubt, and Gwyneth Paltrow played Angela, and that was one of her first roles.
No way.
Yeah, and her mom, Blythe Danner, played Bonnie, so...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if you ever want to see a future Oscar winner in a terrible made-for-TV movie about this case, then that's where you can go.
This makes me sad Blockbuster isn't around for us to go get this.
I know, but there's YouTube. I'm sure it's on YouTube.
Okay. I'll take a look. Well, thanks so much for tuning in again, everyone, and listening to The Pros and Cons. You can, of course, get in touch with us in several ways by email at theprosandconspodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us at Pros and Cons Show on Twitter and at The Pros and Cons Podcast on both Instagram and Facebook. And while you're on our Instagram or Facebook page, be sure to stop by and say hi, send us a DM, tag us in your story, let us know how and where you're listening. And as always, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts and your favorite Android app.
Yes.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Before we sign off, I just wanted to tell you about a new podcast I'm executive producing called The Intersection of Cancer and Life. It is hosted by my dear friend, Emily Garnett, who was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in November 2017. Emily and her guests discuss the changes, challenges, and unexpected shifts that have occurred while living with cancer. These conversations emphasize the fact that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to rebuilding a life after diagnosis, and lets listeners know that they are not alone, whether they themselves have been diagnosed with cancer or have a friend or loved one navigating treatment. You can listen to the first season now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and your favorite podcast app by searching for The Intersection of Cancer and Life.